Are there any questions?
I wanted to ask you about,
yes, many people do this. They are non-existentialists to the extent that they go to work and sustain themselves in the everyday world and live in terms of traffic laws and other requirements. But when they put down the workaday world, they go off into this existentialist kind of nonsense. Yes. This is very true. And one of the problems on the college campuses is this unwillingness to leave the academic world for a workaday world. This is a compromise. Now, in the riots in Berkeley, in the various meetings they held, one sign that they had over and over again that they were waving, "We do not trust anyone over 30. Why? Because they said everyone over 30 had compromised with his faith. He was thinking in terms of a job, and he had a wife, and was thinking in terms of a baby. And what kind of an existentialism is this? It was compromising, and therefore the banner, "We trust no one over 30. Now, these students, of course, dread the day, and that's why you have so many professional students in the academic world. People who simply will not give up. They want to remain as students. Most of the time, they're just there taking part in campus activities. There are thousands of them around Berkeley. And getting involved in endless politicking. They don't want to grow up and leave their existentialist pipe dream. Another question, yes?
When Karen got a little further down, studying her with Connecticut, there was a kind of a spiritual stream, you know, and it was pretty new, like, a girl with that voice and everything, do you know what that is?
Yes, it is a schizophrenic position. The logical existentialist is the one who commits suicide. And Nietzsche, in this respect, counseled suicide as the ultimate course for the logical humanist. In his case, he ended up in a form of suicide in that he went stark raving mad. But this was his counsel. And in a book which was in many respects a very prophetic one, Dostoevsky's The Possessed, or it can be also translated The Demons, Kirillov, one of the first, if not the first, existentialist portrayed in literature, finally commits suicide. It is one way of logically denying God. Yes, this is a satirical comment on the position of these existentialists of the Death of God school of theology. And by the way, their great white father is Bishop Robinson and Paul Tillich. These two men are their sources of inspiration. But they deny God. The death of God is the first premise. Then, of course, Jesus Christ as God. Then they take a purely human Jesus, who is a social revolutionist, no relationship to the biblical Jesus, as their goal, and say, "We want a Jesus who's going to save the world politically, socially, so that the true Jesus of the God who is to be born, this united humanity, is the one or the institution bearing his name, which will create this perfect one world order. So this is their purely mythical Jesus. Yes. Yes.
You mentioned that the church accepted it from the condition of God by love, is that right now?
Yes.
And then on the other hand, you have many human beings who are outside the church who don't consider love at all. It's their own well-being.
Yes.
Even those two extremes, you're going to get all kinds of love of love.
Right. You're very right. They're all forms of existentialism, but for all of them, basically, it's their own existence that is their only love. And for Sartre, for example, and his position is, the existence or non-existence of God is no concern to me. The only problem is these other people, whether they exist for me or not. In other words, do I choose to recognize your existence or not? This is the only problem for Sartre, because he lives in a totally self-contained world. Now, his answer has been a thoroughly leftist answer to that. He's decided that he will recognize the rest of us if we come into a totally statist order, such as he has in mind. But, again, for him, the only reality is that which he chooses to recognize. And logically, Sartre doesn't have to be a Marxist or anything. His basic position is such that he has admitted that some of his best pupils have committed suicide. He isn't ashamed of that fact. Now, I think Sartre's book, Saint Genet, is the best example of what he regards as desirable. Sartre wrote this book about Jean Genet. Genet is a French ex-convict who has had a long life of thoroughly depraved activity as a professional male prostitute, pervert, pickpocket, thief, quite a few things. And some few years ago, about 10, 15 years ago, he was facing a long term in a French prison. And Genet decided, why should I be considered a criminal? If there is no God, there is no law. And if there is no law, there is no crime. Therefore, I'm a saint of the new world, the godless world. And so he began to write along this line, and all the philosophers rallied around him and got his him pardoned and put out of prison. And Sartre wrote this book on him, Saint Genet. He is the saint of existentialism, because his principle is, if there is no God, there is no law. If there is no law, there is no crime. And if there is no crime, I as a criminal, breaking the old laws of God, and the saint. And he's logical, he's right, if his premise is right. But of course, he is an exceedingly depraved person. And he is one of the heroes of existentialism today, Jean Genet. You'll find on some college campus bookstores stacks of his books like this for sale. Yes. Yes, neo-orthodoxy is a form of existentialism. The great figure in existentialism is also the great figure in molding neo-orthodoxy, Kierkegaard. K-I-E-R-G-E. K-I-E-R-G-E. No, K-I-E-R-K-E, excuse me, G-A-A-R-D. Kierkegaard, it sounds, but Kierkegaard is pronounced. Now, Kierkegaard was a Kantian. So, Immanuel Kant is the real fountainhead of existentialism. And it has taken two directions. Its basic influence in philosophy and in religion, and to a great extent in education, has come through Kierkegaard. Its basic political influence has come through Hegel, and Marx, of course, was a Hegelian to the core. Dewey was also a Hegelian.
Yeah. I found much about using the relative the college in an article where they're using it in Harvard School of Divinity as a, it seems as though an official course in the school almost. Are you finding much of that?
Yes, there is a great deal of use of LSD in colleges, and there's not too much that you can put your finger on, but there seems to be evidence that it is being used in seminaries, not only in the East, but also in the West. That apparently some leaders in seminaries have gone so far as to regard it as the modern substitute for the Holy Spirit.
I had a great deal of stuff in the Fellowship of Lutheran Sarajevo to recommend him.
Well, it's exceedingly prevalent, and it is increasing in its use.
Where do these people leave their what they're built then, because being just human, and kind of they have, they must have some feeling of guilt under their position of family or what they're really doing.
Yes, a good question. It varies from existentialist thinker to thinker. Of course, they're all Freudian in their approach in that they're going to say it's not a religious question, it's a scientific question and a hangover from the primal part. But part of the necessity of escaping into this dream world of LSD is to escape from guilt feeling. Now, this presents a problem, too, because whether they take peyote or LSD, you have to be very careful of the dosage, because the wrong kind of dosage and all your guilt feelings can pour up to the surface in such a fantastic way that it tears the person apart and can lead to suicidal impulses. But it can be a devastating experience. They can see demons, serpents. It can be a wild, wild experience if they don't control the dosage and keep it limited, and if they are not prepared when they take it. They must take it under controlled circumstances and relaxed, or it gallops away with them.
Maybe it seems a little bit later, but I think I don't know, but some people would explain
it. Yes, some people do. Many people have different forms of idolatry, but when they worship money, they are worshiping ultimately their self-will. It's what money will do for them to enable them to gratify themselves, to give them the sense of power they want. Yes, of course, but the basic security they want is the fulfillment of their will. They can have externally a great... No, it need not be to buy anything. For example, one of the richest women in the history of America, Hetty Green, was fantastically wealthy. Her money ran into the hundreds of millions. And yet she was so niggardly cancer. She refused to call in a doctor for her son when he was seriously ill, and I believe he lost a leg or something as a result of it and became crippled for life. She just didn't want to put the money out for a doctor. And she lived all her life that way. And she enjoyed the sense of utter power, but she didn't want to use money, although she couldn't have spent all she had in a lifetime. Yes? Yes. Yes. Exactly. What people want in money when they go to it for ungodly reasons is power. And our Lord said it's not money that is the root of all evil, but the love of money. So it's the person and his feelings as he approaches it. It's his desire for total power through it. And to control people and to control man, to play God. But there is nothing wrong with wealth as such. In fact, God makes it clear over and over again in Scripture that this is a blessing. And he blesses his saints very often materially with monetary wealth. Some he blesses in spiritual ways and some in material ways. That's in the providence of God. But there is nothing wrong, absolutely nothing morally wrong with being wealthy, if the wealth be honest wealth.
Yes. Would it be relevant at this time to discuss the physical source of LSD and temporary history?
Yes, LSD is manufactured predominantly in Israel and is brought into this country. That's the major source. There is a foundation of two Harvard professors, O'Leary and I forget the name of the other man who have founded a foundation dedicated to the promulgation of it and are enthusiastic champions of it. They moved to Mexico for a while when they were finally kicked out of Harvard because of some scandals there. But they are back in this country because I believe Mexico made it clear that they were not wanted.
Now, I'm just getting into this LSD. The quickest thing to say is that you're on a trip. And there's a tremendous corollary between the two things. I suppose that you really think it's great to bring that trip in relation to using any kind of drug, whether it be marijuana or LSD. And it's very common.
Yes. Yes, you're very right. It's interesting, you mentioned Brave New World. He calls the drug there Soma, as you said. A few years ago, I was reading in a medical journal. I was sitting in a friend's office with a doctor. That's how I happened to read it. It isn't my normal reading. So there was an article on Soma. And they have come to the conclusion that there actually once existed such a plant, a soma plant. All the evidence points to the fact that in northern India this plant once existed, and that by using the roots they could go off into this dream world. But they finally made it extinct because they were searching high and low throughout the mountains for it and digging it up, and finally they killed it off entirely. But Soma once existed, and we can be glad it no longer does, but we do have the artificial forms. Now, very closely related to LSD is POV. I have had a great deal of experience with that, in that when I was with the American Indians, they are very much addicted to its use. It came into the Indian world in the 90s from Mexico. And the peyote button, it's legal for the Indians. This was made legal by the New Deal because they claimed it was for religious purposes, a part of their worship. And it's brewed at the sea, or they chew it, or put it into stews, and so on. And it has the same effects as LSD. But it is significant that the Indians who use it are the most incompetent and most defeated ones. They're people who have no desire to make any progress. They live under the most abject conditions. They will be sometimes in a log cabin, no larger than this inner area here, with a dirt floor, 10, 12, 14 people sleeping there, and perpetually, almost, during some parts of the year, under the influence of the peyote. They especially give it to sick people. And it's regarded as a great healer. The healing property is simply this: you don't feel a thing. However, because it paralyzes the whole digestive tract, and so much of your pain is connected with the digestive tract, it has an effect on the heart, so you don't feel much. However, what does happen, that people who take peyote and are not in good health, it virtually stops all digestion, and the food just piles up, and they look as though they've got a small basketball at their belt, and it kills them. And I've buried many a peyote victim, but it was significant that no government record ever put down peyote as the cause of death. No government doctor would dare do this. Many states have passed laws against peyote, and it is valid, but not against the Indians. California, in the last 3-4 years, did try to prosecute some Indians, I believe, in the Palm Springs area for using peyote, and they did find that a very large number of convicts in San Quentin were perpetually high on peyote that was being smuggled into them. It's a very common form of retreat from a world you've given up on and you don't want to do a thing about. Yes?
I happened to read an article by a while ago, and I think that it's accurate in saying that the Mayans used to be the same relation to the victims for the corn factory. And when they went up the little steps, they were topped up with a stone batter, and you know, sacrificed the stuff you want to survive and all of that.
I believe you're right. I don't know particularly with respect to the Mayans, but I do know that many of the Indian peoples in Central America did use it for ritual purposes. They controlled it because, while they knew its power and liked it, they didn't want it to be used too freely because it would destroy society. Yes? Yes, the sacred mushroom of some of the Indian tribes was discovered. I don't know whether the same men did the discovery, but it was discovered, and some experimentation has taken place with that also.
That's one of the things they went down in Mexico for. I read an article 7 years ago and started to post about these two guys. And
there are many such drugs that we are still ignorant of. I know that when I went to the reservation, one of the old Indians whose grandparents had been medicine people often pointed out to me that never, when any Indian was around, many ordinary plants in the hills which had powerful properties for inducing trances and visions. And he said it's a good thing that knowledge of this is now forgotten, because he said these things are very dangerous. But today we are on the search for these things because we are running away from reality. That's the basic reason. And hence, there is a demand for something. Now, Aldous Huxley wrote an article in the Saturday Review about 7 or 8 years ago in which he expressed a hope that something would be developed, and he hoped that LSD would be the thing, which would enable man to escape from reality without any consequences. So there is this desire to escape from reality, and this governs this continual quest for drugs that will have no consequences. Yes?
I don't like saying it, but certainly my colleagues have been reading some of his articles, and I've talked about these things, and then also the local minister in South Street.
There's a great deal of experimentation. In fact, there are a number of foundations that are involved in this experimentation and some universities on the West Coast. So, while there isn't too much publicly stated about this, there is far more activity than we realize. There were those who felt that the and those who knew, who said that the crowds that were picketing at the Republican National Convention included a lot of top heads and a lot of LSD people. And so I think one more question.
I get the drift of your question.
I think it depends on the person. Different people go to it for different things, but basically it's a person whose life is without faith and without meaning, and so he either takes it to escape something in his own life or in the world. It is also promoted, I believe, in part because it is destructive of people. It is destructive of character. And it does weaken a people and make them more susceptible to command. So I think there are many motives for it, but it is certainly a burning out of the individual when he goes onto the narcotics.
I wanted to be refreshing my memory for that.
your lecture on Freud, you mentioned this problem of sin and how they're using Freud to deal with it.
Yes. In my paperback on Freud, I call attention to the fact that Freud is not primarily a philosopher of sex or a psychologist or psychiatrist dealing with sex, but with the problem of guilt. Because Freud said that man could not hope ever to abolish religion, and he felt this was desirable, as long as men were guilty. And he said, all men feel guilty. All men are guilt-ridden. And you can never hope to cope with this by any treatises, scientific studies, which say there is no God, and proving this endlessly, scientifically and philosophically. So Freud said, the only way you can abolish religion is by converting the problem of sin or guilt from a religious problem to a scientific problem, so that it is not a matter any longer for a minister, a biblical minister, but for a mental health specialist. And this he did by going to anthropology, to the primal horde myth, according to which mankind, having evolved out of the primal horde, a group of half-human or subhuman creatures who ran in a pack with the strongest man ruling them and possessing all the women and driving out all the sons, he said that finally these sons banded together and killed the old man and ate him and possessed the mothers and sisters. So he said, the three basic instincts of mankind are incest, parricide, and cannibalism. And the three basic counter-instincts are the prohibitions of these three things. And so he said, this is why man feels guilty. He has these three basic instincts and these three counter-instincts. Now, all your modern psychologies and your modernistic churches with their mental health programs, and the whole mental health program is based on this Freudian premise. They may disagree with Freud in everything else, but they are agreed with him that guilt must be transferred from religion to science and must be made a biological problem instead of a spiritual problem. This is the essence of Freud's approach to this. So Freud would agree with me that, of course, society is geared to deal with the problem of guilt and to make atonement for guilt. But his answer is through the mental health program and total control and mental reconditioning of men. Yes?
Would you define what you mean when you use the word religion?
The word religion is a noun which, in a sense, has no substance. We commonly use it to define a faith. But you cannot speak of religion per se. In other words, there is no religion behind all the religions, so that you can use religion as a substitute for the word faith, the faiths of man, the beliefs of man. But if you speak of it as a substantive kind of noun, it's invalid, because there are religions. Buddhism, Confucianism, Taoism, Mohammedanism, and so on. But there is no such thing as religion per se. What can you define as religion? Well, you can't say it's a belief in God that's common to all of these, because Buddhism doesn't believe in God. And many religions are atheistic. Humanism is an atheistic religion. So that in this sense of religion as representing something common to all, the word is invalid. There is no meaning there.
Is man a religious creature by nature?
Yes. Adjectivally, the word has very real meaning. It means that man is inescapably religious. He must worship something. He is either a covenant keeper with God or a covenant breaker. So man is inescapably religious. Yes.
Would you agree with the Veritas Foundation or Veritas Foundation that the troika that gives up modern day Satanism would be Einstein in the scientific realm, Freud in the religious, and Marx in the political?
Not quite. I think the great triumvirate of modern thinking is Darwin, Marx, and Freud. And this is not merely my opinion, but I think one commonly subscribed to by scholars. You occasionally have such opinions which give variations. I've seen one, Darwin, Marx, and Wagner, which seems to me a peculiar combination. Jacques Barzun made that study. But it is clearly Darwin, Marx, and Freud. And Darwin to provide the basis for the other two, because when Darwin's book came out, Origin of Species, in 1859, Karl Marx was delighted, and he said, this has saved socialism. Now we can have scientific socialism. And Freud built on Darwin also. So the three have their fountainhead, so to speak, in Darwin. And the reason for this is a very simple one. Darwin, by the evolutionary hypothesis, made man not a creature of God, but a product of evolutionary forces. Therefore, and he also gave a picture in the process of a world that was not only without God, but which was a blind, struggling force. So there was no law above man in the heavens, God. No law in nature, natural law. That was abolished. So where was law to come from? Man. So the only source of truth is man, and the only source of control and of direction is man. So man controls his own evolution in the future. Now, this invalidated, Marx and Freud believed, religion, and therefore the way to control the future was through science, and scientific socialism was therefore guaranteed, and it supplanted utopian socialism. Now, what does scientific socialism mean? Well, the essence of science is that it is experimental. Now, a thing is truly scientific, according to these people, if it is experimental, and to be experimental, it must, all factors must be controlled. Now, scientific socialism and the scientific state and scientific planners are planners and socialists who believe in the total control of all factors. So that when they visualize a scientific order in the future, they are visualizing an order in which everything is totally controlled, because it cannot be a valid experimental situation otherwise. I shall be speaking this weekend at the creation seminar, of which there are some flyers here for those of you who would like them, on man in 1984. What I shall be doing, in essence, is to be reviewing several publications recently by scientists, including one two-volume study by American and British scientists, The World in 1984. As they plan The World in 1984, just to give you a mild taste of some of the things in the book, there will be no longer any area of nature which is not controlled. There will be no wildernesses left. Because to have a scientific state, you must control not every bit of man, but every bit of the world. So the wilderness will disappear. There will be planned areas like park reserves, but far more strictly controlled, with the plant life there allowed to live in terms of a census and killed off when they exceed it, because it has to be absolutely scientific. So that everything, including the animal life of the world, is going to be strictly governed in terms of this total scientific control. Now, this idea of the scientific state, the scientific control of all things, is basic, and Darwin was the foundation, Marx built upon it, and Freud capped it. Yes?
Aren't they then being inconsistent with their own beliefs? Don't they believe that they are the victims of nature? So, or in other words, they're under nature. So how can they control?
Except that they believe the elite will now control nature totally. And they will not only control nature, but will remake nature. One British physicist has gone so far as to say that in a few million years, if the sun should die, they will remake a sun, build another sun and put it in the heavens. Some of the thinking in these recent studies as they visualize the future are truly fantastic. I think you had a taste of it in the four issues of Life recently, in which they talked about breaking the genetic code and governing man's heredity before he was born, so that it would be possible, they said, to make men who would be able to live on the floor of the ocean or on Jupiter. This is wild imagination. Yes?
Do you think there's an answer by God about the time that Darwin was expounding his theory and Marx was going after the political fact that archaeology was sort of put on the face of the earth and began to counter with facts the theories of unproven men like Darwin?
Yes, archaeology has done a great deal in recent years to confirm the biblical record, and I think it is significant that at no point, although once or twice they thought that they found something that would contradict the Bible, have they found anything that did. We don't realize how much our history has been affected by the Bible, and how far afield people thought the Bible was. For example, it was once adjudged that all of the Old Testament was fantastically full of mythology because it talked of a great empire, Assyria, which everybody knew never existed. Now, it seems hard for us today when you can go to any library and get volume after volume on Assyria. And we have recovered Ashurbanipal's library, or portion of the, I think, about a third to a half of the 100,000 volumes he had in his library. And we thus have a great deal of information about him. But there was a time when the memory of Assyria was gone, when Alexander the Great and other conquerors marched over the ruins and didn't know it existed. So that people treated the Bible as mythological because it talked about Assyria. And today, of course, Assyriology is one of the established branches of study in universities. Or again, you still hear people talk about the book of Daniel as myth and written in the Maccabean period rather than by a person named Daniel. And yet, this is what we have found in recent years. No one believed it could be possibly accurate. It talked about things that we didn't know in history. Obviously were not true. It speaks of Belshazzar as the king on the night that Babylon fell. Nobody had ever heard of Belshazzar. It was obvious that Nabonidus was the emperor at the time. That was what all the historical records told us. Well, not too long ago, they discovered in the course of excavations that actually Nabonidus, the stepson, Belshazzar, the stepson of Nabonidus, was the vice emperor, a common thing in the empires of that day. And Nabonidus was at that time elsewhere with the armies, and he had made Belshazzar the vice emperor in his absence. And so when Belshazzar offers Daniel that if he will make known the meaning of the inscription on the wall, he will make him third in the empire, he was saying, after me, because he was second. Now, this is one of dozens and dozens of details that recent studies and excavations have turned up with regard to the book of Daniel. And you could go on to book after book, which has been confirmed in amazing detail as a result of excavations. I think one of the most amusing things in archaeological studies was one in ancient Ur of the Chaldees a few years ago. They did some excavating and came down into this large room. I believe it was about the size of this room without this office area knocked out of it, including the hole. And they picked up some objects, and well, here was one from a particular century, and here was another next to it about 10 centuries before, and here was one 5 centuries before that, and they were completely befuddled until, as they began to read some of the inscriptions, they realized they had stumbled into an archaeological museum in ancient Ur of the Chaldees. Think not to be martyrs.
Yeah.
Right. Our Lord indeed asks us to be sensible, and he counseled the disciples as they went out and spoke, and he said, if they will not receive you in the one city, go to the next. And Paul, when he found opposition arising, he left. He was not called to make a fool of himself by sacrificing himself needlessly. He was unafraid when opposition confronted himself. He didn't go out to create it. He witnessed boldly, and then he passed on. If they would not hear him, he shook the dust off his feet and went out. Now, anyone can prepare themselves to live in the world of 1984, but they've got to recognize this. They're not going to get along with God. They may get along with the world of 1984, but not with God. And I think of the two, God is going to be around a lot longer. I don't think the world of 1984 is going to be with us more than 3-4 years, very briefly. So I think it's up to people to make their choice. And I am a lot more confident of God's world than I am of 1984, and I'm a lot more afraid of God than I am of the powers of 1984.
So what will you tell the children?
I will tell them.
Although they will be.
I believe that we must stand in terms of our faith. That's it. That we really don't have a choice. Yes.
Something recently came to my mind when the Troika was mentioned, and thought of a Godhead, and an explanation that I had never heard before, but was so vivid, was that it was the Godhead was explained as the sun, which you can't see, is God, and the light that comes from the sun, which you can see, is Jesus. And the power, the chemical power of the sun's rays, just like on its rising glory. Can you explain a little bit more on that? That's all I recall having heard about it.
That's a good illustration. all illustrations are limited because they are limited by our experience and our knowledge. And the Trinity, which is the heart of our faith, is in a sense beyond our imagination. We would have to have the mind of God to understand God. And we have to take him on faith. So that we have to recognize, indeed, God the Father, God the Son, and God the Holy Spirit, indeed represent the three persons of the Godhead, three persons, one God. And the Holy Spirit, indeed, is the power that works in this world and among us. And God the Son is he who descended into our midst and whom we saw. But beyond that, we have to say these illustrations are often, and this one is a good one, valuable, but ultimately it has to be an act of faith. We take electricity on faith. Actually, scientists don't know what electricity is. It's a power that they've learned to harness and to work with. We don't know, for example, some of the elementary things about digestion. We give names to the process, but we really don't know how a cow can eat green grass and make white milk, which you and I can drink to produce, say, brown or red or gray hair. We give names to the process, but we don't understand it, really. The world around us is full of things that are beyond our understanding. One of the things I recall when I was still quite young, I was interested in being an astronomer. That was one of my first ambitions. And I was reading this book on astronomy, and I came across this sentence on the last page or two. It was dealing with some of the modern astrophysics, and it said, "Space is finite, yet infinite." Well, that staggered me. That just didn't make sense. And then as I began to read a little further, I found that the more they dealt with this universe, the more it was impossible to use language, and they were simply using mathematical formula to describe what they were dealing with. Now, if the world is so great, how much greater is God? And so the imagination staggers before it all, and we simply have to say, "I believe." And I think that's the beauty of the creed. The creed is personal. The creed does not say, "We believe in God the Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth, and in Jesus Christ, his only begotten Son," and so on. When we repeat the creed, even though we do it in unison, we each say, "I." That's the only way you can believe. "I believe." And so, ultimately, we all must say that with respect to the Trinity, as well as with respect to the Scripture. "I believe." Well,
I want you to call it from your iPhone and I can send it magazine. There might be some that don't realize it. If ever we have it, Evelyn, do you have the American Kingdom?
Yes.
I think I just want to be sure that you know about
it. I have an article on the current American Kingdom, and this is the fact that Mrs. Flanagan has called attention to on the subversion of American seminaries. And as I have indicated at other times, I believe that our churches are one of the two most subverted institutions in the United States. I would rate them the most subverted. Second would be the cross. But the importance of understanding the subversion of the church is this, and it's a fact that I think some of you have heard me state before, and it bears repeating. In the United States, there are more people in church on any given Sunday than have ever voted in any national election. And these people are the property owners, the voters, the office holders, the professional people, the responsible people of the United States. And so, long ago, well before the Communist Revolution, subversives had decided that the church must be captured. And if the church can be captured, then we can control the United States. so they very, very early became a target. And today, of course, they are predominantly suburban. And in the article, I traced the subversion of the seminary in particular. Yes.
I'd like to ask you a question. When you made mention of the fact that the United Nations was participating in social insurance, I found that statement not only provocative but argumentative. Because I'm directly concerned with the impact that kind of statement would have on people who do not fully understand what the United Nations is trying to do. Not that they are totally out of contact with them, but being partially at least in contact with them, and establishing the covenant relationship with them, and in turn establishing the covenant relationship between human beings. How can you make a statement like that?
Well, first of all, how are they in covenant with God?
There must be some religious people in it. There must be some people in the United Nations who believe in Jesus. I would never accept the fact that there is no one there to believe that way, but they might accept themselves.
Well, first of all, I would say possibly there are. I've read through a number of UN documents at the Stanford Library, UN documents. I find no evidence of Christian thinking in what they do, and a great deal of evidence of anti-Christian thinking. Then the fundamental premise of the UN is this, that you can take everyone and bring them together and bring some good out of it. You can bring good and evil together. Communist nations and nations that are dedicated to a republican form of government, and somehow, by this amalgamation, some good is going to follow. It's like saying, if we get the police and the criminal elements together, then we can have law and order. And this premise, I believe, is a very deadly one and destructive of anything. So that I think it's highly questionable that any good can come out of the UN. Then, basic to the UN's philosophy is the concept of universal jurisdiction, irrespective. This is in the Charter. Irrespective of whether anyone is a member or not, and irrespective of whether any nation ratifies a particular declaration of the UN. The UN claims universal jurisdiction. And this is a usurpation of tremendous dimension. They feel they have the right to interfere in any country under any circumstances. The only thing preventing them from exercising it is that they have sufficient power as yet to do so everywhere. So I think the UN, because it has this, first of all, mingling of good and evil without any qualification between the nations, a basically a fallacious principle of organization, and second, because it claims so universal a jurisdiction, is something that a Christian cannot very well accept.
Well, man's law, of course, cannot be the true God's law. I think we all know that. But at least, I think it is an attempt to bring into the open those factors of human nature that probably will be covered up if this sort of vision did not exist. At least it allows an opening for thinking so that people can express themselves publicly. Whereas, if these things allow the pressure to manifest themselves in other kinds of great tensions, perhaps it's less humanity to have this go on and have these things.
Perhaps, but actually, it hasn't solved anything, and it has complicated our world problems tremendously. And there has been never any lack of real expression on the part of the people. And more good was done in the last century by the free flow of ideas and of trade. than is being done by the UN. When you consider, for example, what free enterprise did in the last century, free trade in Africa and in Asia, anything that the UN could dream up by comparison is very feeble. And what the UN is doing is to destroy all these things, because instead of emphasizing a grassroots growth and a natural development, its approach is to act from the top down, and it destroys everything. Now, a few weeks ago, when we were discussing family life, I called attention to some statistics which I think are very revealing as to what the UN is doing, and American and Russian foreign aid also, in Africa. Since the African countries have gained independence, you have seen a tremendous breakdown of life in the rural areas. 30% of the population now are in cities, and cities were few and far between in Africa 10 and 15 years ago. But they have flocked to the cities. What for? We have an international handout in the cities. In the countryside, what has taken place? Life is broken down. Because in rural Africa, and I'm excluding the Union of South Africa from these figures, in rural Africa, 70% of the men are gone. They're in the cities, living on beer and UN handouts, and American and USSR handouts somewhat too. And it means that in the countryside, only the old men and the young boys are left. Africa is in a state of collapse because of this fact. Radical social disintegration. But what was happening under the old system? The traders would go into an area, and they would, in return for, say, animal hides, for goods grown by the natives, peanuts or whatever else it was, give them goods or money. They were stimulating the peaceful development of Africa. They were civilizing it, because it was an incentive to these people, in order to get the traders' goods, to go out and clear a piece of land and farm it. Now we've destroyed all that, so that Africa today is worse off than it was a century and a half ago. And this comes from this kind of activity from the top. I believe that free enterprise is the greatest internationalizing agency the world has ever seen. And the UN, given everything under the sun, every power under the sun, could never begin to touch a fraction of what free enterprise has done and can do in every part of the world.
And so the human beings, but also the element of exploitation is involved in things of science. And that's how to justify it. I mean, there is nothing yet from that. But there is this element of exploitation. This is, I think, just as bad as from one viewpoint as you see the UN policy from another viewpoint.
A few years ago, I would have agreed with you, but I've increasingly come to doubt this exploitation idea. And exploitation can be used, by the way, in both a good and a bad sense.
Let me give you a perfect example of that. For the institution of slavery in the United States, and the grad people in the United States, and the government.
Well, the institution of slavery, as it was introduced into the United States, of course, was, I think, a serious mistake for the United States. But for the Negroes involved, it was the best thing that ever happened to them. Because the Negroes in the United States, at their poorest, are living better than most of the people of Europe and all of the people of the USSR and the people of Africa. And the riots were not caused by any evil they experienced, but by their own sin. So that even where we did wrong in introducing slavery, which we couldn't have done without the help of the Africans, because it was African chiefs, let us never forget, who rounded up these people and sold them, and they were bringing them to the corrals faster than the ships could bring them over. And that's why they were packing them in such great numbers that sometimes a lot of them died en route. because the teens were glutting the market with it. But be that as it may, when you have a free situation, even evils are made to work for ultimate good. So that the situation that is developed now has been one of an evil that has come about in recent years because of government interference. Now, I'd like to take a little time, if you'll bear with me, because I think this is important, a very important point, and I'm grateful to you for bringing this up, because it gives me an opportunity. Now, you and I have 2,000 years of Christian ancestry approximately behind us, give or take a century or two, because we are products of Western civilization. This has meant selective breeding. This has meant that certain people were regarded as unfit socially and fell to the bottom and gradually bred themselves out. Until World War I, this is based on studies of records in Western Europe and the United States going back for centuries. This is what they found. Out of every 100 people who were very devout Christians, and whose records you can find in the churches right straight through, and evidences and data concerning their faith, out of every 100, you had something like 385 children. Out of every 100 people who were good citizens but not Christians, there were about 118 or 20 children. Out of every 100 people who were consistently in and out of trouble with the law, the criminal element and the near criminal and vagrant element, the number of children were very low, about 20, 22 per 100. Now, what does this mean? It meant that in our Western Christian culture, the Christians were the ones who were multiplying, the non-Christians barely so, and the worst elements were being bred out. This meant a progressive strengthening, improving, developing of Western stuff. Now, you have, however, in Africa, untold centuries where the people have been living in terms of incredible depravity. Go to Sir Samuel Baker's two volumes of the first exploration to the sources of the Nile. And as he describes, and he's a Victorian, the conditions that he sees among people who've never seen a white man, had no contact with any other civilization. And it's almost unrepeatable. These people live in terms of the feeling, well, if I don't gorge on all the sex and all the food I can today, I may be dead tomorrow in somebody's cup, eating myself. So all the sex, all the liquor, all the women I can get right now. Now, they were breeding in terms of this. This was survival. All right. The Negro was brought to America. Now, when the slaves were freed, what happened? Immediately, the selectivity of freedom began to set in. The Negro population in the United States from the Civil War to 1933, in its ratio to the general population, began to decline. Why? Because the worst element among the Negroes were falling to the bottom, they were in and out of trouble with the law, they were not reproducing themselves. And the better element was slowly rising to the top. So the Negro population was declining in its ratio to the general population. And population experts figured that, given a couple of hundred years, most of the Negroes would disappear from the United States just by this natural process. But those that survived would grow in ability through selectivity, through survival, and be able to merge with the general population. They would be accepted. they would have met the general standards. What happened? Well, beginning with the New Deal, we had a gigantic welfare program. Today, the worst element among the Negroes, it represents the most prolific element in the United States, those on welfare. So that the Negro element in our population is being destroyed today, because it's no longer the better element that's growing numerically, but the worst element. And so today, great harm has been done to the Negro. And it's predominantly the welfare element among the Negroes that has been responsible for these social disturbances. So that government interference, whether from Washington or the UN, is destructive of social order. And this is what we have seen take place with respect to the Negro in American life. Well, our constitutions originally did far more than represent God, that is the state constitution. They had various specific requirements that have all been dropped. The Constitution does not mention God because the framers of the Constitution knew it would never be ratified if they did. And the clergymen of all of the colonies felt so strongly that they insisted on the writing of the First Amendment. In other words, religion is not within the jurisdiction of the federal government. It is a matter of state rights. And originally, Christianity is the established religion of every one of the 13 states. And 9 of the 13 had established churches. The others, 3 of them had plural establishments, and 3 had established Christianity as such as the religion of the state. But they were all not only given to mentioning God, but having various requirements of what you could believe. So that, according to the Constitution, it is totally, as it was written, within the province of a state to say that it is going to be Christian or non-Christian, to require prayer or to require a particular kind of faith for citizenship. This is, of course, being steadily outlawed. It's been in the papers lately, for example, that Maryland grand jury indictments have been tossed out because Maryland belief in God is necessary to serving on a grand jury. Similar action took place last year in New Jersey. In New Jersey, it was necessary for a witness to accept an action involving himself to believe in God for his testimony to be acceptable. This was once universal in all the states. Yes?
Do you believe that Christianity is the only faith by which one can have communion with God?
Very definitely.
What about the devotion and the devoutness of the Mahometans and the Bible, even not too far away, far away from?
Well, the Quran is very far away from our Bible. I have read the Quran clear through, and I don't believe there is any comparison. Its doctrines are radically different. Its morality, I don't think you would find acceptable. And the practice of the Mohammedans based on their morality is, I think, a very unspeakable one. I feel that Mohammedanism represents one of the worst evils under the sun. Then if we are to follow the Bible with any kind of integrity, it makes it clear that this is the way of salvation and there is none other. Christianity is an exclusive religion. It says that truth is one. There are not several mutually contradictory things that are true, but truth cannot have a contradiction. And if we say that Christianity is true and Mohammedanism is true, we are saying that black is black, but black is also white when we choose it to be so. We cannot reconcile things that are irreconcilable. And the Bible says there is none other name under heaven by which men may be saved than Jesus Christ. Very categorically stated.
It helps me to reconcile my thinking that God will sacrifice 600 or 700 million people who have never had the opportunity to know him.
They all have had the opportunity to know him, and they all do know him. And the Bible asserts this emphatically, not only in Romans 1, where this is the thesis of the chapter, but many places else, where it says that God is known to all men, and the invisible things of this world are made visible to them by their conscience, by their heart. And men have this witness crying out in them. And Paul says, they hold the truth, but more accurately it can be translated, they hold down the truth. They sit on top of it. They suppress it in unrighteousness. So that it is the sin of man that leads to it. Then we must not be guilty of the fallacy of seeing other people as ourselves. You know yourself as a person of good character and generally decent standards and taste, but you cannot read, for example, the people in the heart of Africa in terms of that. They represent centuries of selective breeding, as I've indicated, in terms of a very different standard. You could go, for example, to some peoples, such as the some of the people, for example, in India, North India, Pushtani peoples, I forget the name. Pathans is the more popular name for them. The Pathans, for example, there's very little in any library about them because it's almost impossible to write a book that'll pass the censors about them. One of the commonest proverbs among the Pathans, in the most nearly critical form that it can be rendered, is that a woman for children, a boy or a man for entertainment, but a goat for real pleasure. Now, as I say, this is the nearest thing, and I haven't given it literally, to being critical in their ideas and their thinking. They are people so unspeakable that they just don't write books about them. For one thing, a traveler couldn't get in and out among the Pathans very well. Now, this is the way vast segments of the world are today. A few books are written on anthropology that tell about some of the everyday customs of vast areas of the world. And they are on the locked book section of the library, in the locked book section. So first, you have a suppression of the reality of most of mankind. Second, we have in our background the Romantic movement and the Enlightenment with its belief that all men are naturally good. So we approach men in terms of these presuppositions. And we believe that all these things we read are there on those people, when they are not. These people know the truth, but they don't want it. Now, I've spent 8.5 years among the Indians. I like them. But they're not the kind of people that are portrayed in our romantic stories. These were Indians who lived 100 miles from any bus, town, or train line. And while I was there, this was through the 40s, I saw the old generation who saw the white man coming across the plain and fought him, who could tell me of the technique of scalping and so on, describe it in great detail. I saw them die and I buried them. Now, these Indians were not the beautiful characters that were portrayed in the movies and in romantic stories. And their character was one that was pretty hard to report very readily without shocking people. And they knew there was a God. And they said, oh yes, there, we know there's a God, but this was the old generation, as they were asked by the first men who went among them, but he's far away and we don't have to worry about him. They were suppressing knowledge, and they were guilty.